It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll check out a nationwide program that aims to connect high-achieving, low-income students with the best universities and financial aid.
First, when was the last time you paid $2-something a gallon for gas? Well, for many Americans, it might have been yesterday. According to AAA, gas prices at nearly half of the gas stations in the United States fell below $3 on Thursday.
That decrease is part of a global trend that saw oil prices fall from $150 a barrel in mid-June to under $85 by mid-October. This sounds like it could be good news for consumers who are paying less at the pump. In the long term, it may point to a slowdown in the global economy.
Here to talk with us about the trends and what they mean for the average consumer is Abdur Chaudhry, economics professor at Marquette University and former chief economist for the UN Economic Commission in Europe. Abdur, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on your program.
What do we know about why gas prices are down?
There are a couple of reasons why gas prices are falling. Obviously, the most important being that the price of crude oil is dropping in the international market. And as you said, it's about $82 now per barrel. Add to that two other things that are happening within the country. Basically, we have seen historically after Labor Day, usually people drive less, so there is less demand for gas. And also during this time of the year, the refineries usually switch from summer blend to winter blend. Gas. And for winter blend gas, the environmental restrictions are not as much. So it costs less to produce winter blend gas. So all of these are sort of adding together to provide this relief for consumers.
So is it typical then that in the winter gas costs less?
Yes. Compared to summer gas, you will see the winter blend gas cost a little bit less. However, this time, this year, we are feeling it much more because of the drop in gas price in the international market.
Now, it seems like for consumers, this is a no-brainer. This is good news that they're paying less at the pump. Is it good news for everybody?
I would say in the short run for the United States, it is good news. With consumers paying less for gas, they will now have an extra money that they can spend on other products, business firms, airline industries, they will be paying less for fuel. So in the short run, it will be good news for the U.S.
Does that mean, for instance, we're going to see lower airfares?
I'm not sure whether airline industry will lower the airfare because they will always have some other excuse for keeping airfare high. Hmm. But for airline industry, the cost of fuel will significantly drop, yes. And the question is whether they will lower the air price because of that drop in cost.
To put this into context, when was the last time we saw prices this low?
It was at least a couple of years ago. If you remember, I don't think we saw price so low before 2007, 2008. That's when price was below $3 per gallon.
Wow. So how long do you expect this sort of thing to last? Are we going to see a bottom and then ricochet back up again, or is it something different, do you think?
What I'm expecting is that you will see price continue to drop for the next couple of weeks, at least towards the end of November, and price can drop to $2.75, $2.70 per gallon. Then the OPEC countries, they're having a meeting November 27th where they may decide to cut production in order to raise prices. If they decide to cut production, then you will see gas prices going up a little bit in November.
Now, you have said that this is good news for consumers, good news overall, but does it signal anything worrisome about the overall global economy?
I would say the fact that prices are declining in the international market, this is due to a slowing down in a number of regions around the world. If you know the Eurozone countries, they're not doing very well. In Europe, their economy is slowing down. China, we have seen in recent months, their economy has slowed down. So, and because of the slowing down in the global economy, there is less demand for oil in the international market. So we see a supply glut. So in the short run, I don't see any specific impact on the U.S. economy, an adverse impact, But for example, if the slowdown in the global economy continues for a long time, this may have an adverse impact on the U.S. economy in the long run.
Now,
By long run, I mean, say, 6 months down the road.
Gotcha. Well, parts of the United States have benefited from a natural gas and oil boom thanks to hydraulic fracking technology. And that technology, though, it's expensive. And if oil prices continue to fall, or at least to level out, do you think that could make fracking less profitable?
It might. For fracking industry shale gas, sort of $75 per barrel of oil price, that's the break-even point. So currently, a barrel of oil is selling at $82. If it drops below $75, you might see some problem in the oil industry in the U.S.
What is the longest we've ever seen gas prices fall like this and stay low? You mentioned maybe, several months out, at least the end of November, but what is the longest we've seen?
The longest gas prices declining like this we have seen, we go back to the 2007 period. That's when we saw gas prices decline and stay low for a couple of months, in fact.
Now, oftentimes when there is a rise in oil prices, you can point to something that's happening in terms of domestic conflict. And in this case, I'm curious about whether you think the events, with ISIS and Syria and Iraq could have had any effect on what we're talking about here.
It's not having an impact yet. The reason is because the countries in the Middle East that are producing oil, they haven't reduced their production. They basically are continuing to produce a large amount of oil. That's why we are seeing the glut. Also, Russia is producing, they're supplying a significant amount of oil in the international market. So the glut that we see in the international market, that will continue in the coming weeks.
Now, the United States is still easing its way out of a recession, getting back on stable footing. Based on these oil prices and the overall picture, is there anything, big picture here that we should be looking at that could be a signal or a bellwether about the U.S. economy?
The U.S. economy, compared to other regions around the world, is doing reasonably well. There are some pockets of weaknesses here and there, but overall, I would say the U.S. economy is doing pretty well compared to, say, Europe or Japan. Now, going down the road, as I said, in the short run, this drop in oil price is good for our economy. However, one thing that has happened is the dollar has strengthened in value in the last couple of weeks. Now, if dollar stays strong, and if the European economy in particular doesn't improve, the economic condition doesn't improve in the next couple of months, then that will start affecting the U.S. economy. The reason is we export about anywhere from 16 to 20% of our total export goes to Europe. So if the European economy do not improve, that will have an adverse impact on our economy.
Okay, something to watch for. Amdur, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me on your program. Thanks.
We've been talking about falling oil prices with Amdur Chaudhry, economics professor at Marquette University and former chief economist for the UN Economic Commission in Europe. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The high cost of higher education has been a big topic in Wisconsin and beyond. And for low-income students in particular, many of the nation's best-known colleges and universities are not a realistic option, even for academically talented kids.
The organization QuestBridge is trying to change that by connecting high-achieving, low-income students with colleges and financial aid around the country.
Leslie Sullivan joins us now. She's director of student relations for QuestBridge. And by the way, she grew up in Northern Wisconsin. Leslie, welcome back to the state.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on today.
So what is the problem that QuestBridge is trying to tackle?
Sure. As kind of the introduction mentioned, I think what we're really trying to do is increase the percentage of talented low-income students that are attending our country's best colleges and universities. As we, as a country, try to stay competitive in the global economy, it's going to be important to kind of reach for students from all economic backgrounds to kind of contribute to the diversity of opinions that we're seeing in the students that are being educated at these schools.
Now, when I think of a student maybe in a low-income area, they might be academically talented. Maybe they could even get into the college of their choice and get financial aid there. But with so many choices out there, it might be overwhelming to know how to get that. How do you try to bridge that gap?
Sure. So, you know, a large piece of what we do is education. So we really try to teach students about the financial aid options that are out there. And there are a large number of schools across the country who are kind of these schools that are these top schools. Everyone thinks, oh, I could never afford to attend there. But they often have significant need-based financial aid that makes that affordable and makes it the equivalent or cheaper to attend one of these top schools than it is even a local community college.
Well, let's look at this from the student side. How do you connect with high school students around the country and bring them on board?
Sure. So we are a small organization based out of California. And so we're unfortunately not really able to kind of be on the ground going into the classrooms and that type of thing. So we have kind of a large national outreach that we do through kind of email and mail. And we really try to work a lot with teachers and organizations that might have contact with students to get them to apply to our programs. And kind of our first program that we do in a student's life cycle is a program called the College Prep Scholarship for High School Juniors. And that happens in the spring of the junior year for students. And if they're selected through that program, we try to coach them through the college admissions process and offer them resources to make them more competitive college applicants.
And then what happens when they're seniors and actually filling out those applications?
Sure. So as a senior, we have our application process, which is earlier than early, I always say. So our deadline is the end of September, which is a lot earlier than early applications for any schools. But that's because students are kind of able to get a jump start with us, and then we review their applications, and they can kind of use those as the start of an application with our partner schools, who are top colleges across the country, who are guaranteeing to meet full need for any student that's admitted there. And we'll kind of help them understand the process for applying to those schools and give them guidance along the way to a higher level than the broad student population might get.
And you said full costs. I mean, are we talking tuition, room and board, textbooks, meals, and on?
Exactly. It's the full cost of attendance. So they're meeting the full need of the students. So that might be, you know, if there's a student in Wisconsin who's choosing to go to a school that is out of state and has to pay to travel there, that would be part of the cost of attendance. And financial aid can help to cover that type of expense.
And you mentioned kids from Wisconsin. We have seen Wisconsin students get involved and go through this program?
Yes, we have. We've certainly, I don't off the top of my head here have the numbers of Wisconsin students, but we have a large number of students that do apply from Wisconsin and go through the process. And it's something that it's not, it's something that's designed to just help them understand all the options available to them and what the right fit is for them. So it might be something that's closer to them or it might not be. And that's really our ultimate goal, is to help students reach their full potential. And there was a recent study last year done that kind of showed for low-income, high-achieving students, a low proportion. So only about 8% of them are applying to schools in the way that they should be applying. Well, high-income students, only 64% of them are applying in the way that they should. So that's that 8 versus that 64. So we're just trying to narrow that gap a little bit.
Now, suppose a student or a family member or a high school counselor is listening right now and thinking, wow, I know somebody that this could apply to. How would they get started? How do they get rolling on getting connected with you?
Sure. So if anybody knows of anybody, you can always refer students to us through our website at www.questbridge.org. And we have a right on the homepage a refer a student button. And that just tells us about the student and then when the student's kind of eligible to apply for our program. So we're starting our program for juniors or the program for seniors. We'll reach out to the student and let them know that that's open.
Now, flipping to the other side of the equation, you mentioned partner universities. Can you give us examples of a few of the universities and colleges that work with QuestBridge?
Sure. Sure. So, you know, some of our initial schools that we started to work with are Amherst, Rice, Trinity College in Connecticut. And then we also have some larger name schools, Princeton, Stanford, Yale, MIT. It's really a broad mix of schools across the country, universities and liberal arts colleges, schools in big cities, schools in small areas, and just a good kind of combination of characteristics to give students a lot of options.
And I wonder, from the school perspective, what's in it for them? What do they see themselves getting out of reaching out to these high-achieving but low-income students they might not ordinarily see applications from?
Sure. You know, I think any of the schools that do partner with us have an institutional commitment to getting these students onto their campus and supporting them while they're there. And that's really about kind of increasing the diversity on our campuses, which is very important to these schools and to us. As I said at the beginning, and kind of really thinking about where as a nation we want to go and remain competitive, to have a broad range of backgrounds is important.
Now, are you looking, I know you're looking to recruit more students for the program, are you also looking for more schools to get involved? And in particular, I don't think I saw any Wisconsin institutions on the list.
Sure. You know, we're not actively recruiting schools right now. However, if there are schools that feel that they fit kind of our partner school model, they'd be free to reach out to us. But it really does require a significant commitment on the school level, both in terms of that institutional commitment to wanting to recruit and support these students, and then also to what I mentioned earlier, they need to be able to commit to meeting 100% of demonstrated need for all of the students that are admitted, regardless of how they get into the school. And then they also, through our early program, students can match with a school, and for those students, they need to commit to meeting their full financial aid with no parent contribution, no loans for all 4 years. So it's a significant commitment that our partner colleges are making to work with us.
Well, I know our listenership occasionally includes university administrators. If one of them's out there and is thinking, yeah, we should check this out, how does a school go about looking at the criteria and seeing if this is a good fit for them?
Sure. You know, if they think that they're a good fit, they could certainly email us at questions@questbridge.org. And we would forward that on to our partner relations team who handles those relationships.
Now, getting into the program a little more deeply, how long have you been at this?
So the Quest Scholars Program, which is kind of our overarching program, started in 1994 as a five-week summer program to help this type of student prepare them for college. And in about 2003, it was actually the first year of it. 2004 was when they were starting out college. We switched to kind of this current model in an effort to scale, whereas before with a residential program, the cost was quite a bit higher, and we were only able to help about 20 to 40 students per year, whereas now we have close to 2,000 students attending our partner colleges each year.
And are you starting to see a lot of success stories where you're seeing the people going through this program making it through the college of their choice?
We are. It's been really nice. You know, as that timing kind of might note, there at the beginning it obviously was much smaller. So now we're starting to see a larger number of students graduating each year, and we're able to kind of see what they're going off and doing, and we're kind of to the point where they're reaching back out to us and being in touch. So it's really great to kind of see all the places they're going and the things they're doing. And, you know, much like schools, we see our Fulbright scholars and our Rhodes scholars and students going to all the big different companies. And it's nice to know that we had a part in that.
And are the graduates of Quest Bridge, if I can call them graduates, starting to recommend people maybe from their family, their hometown give it a try?
They are. We actually have a really strong ambassadors program that students who are currently in college even participate in helping us to reach out to students who might be thinking about applying. So they help us make phone calls. They go out and do presentations, and they're kind of our on-the-ground army to get all of that done, since there's so few of us here in the office.
Well, Leslie, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Leslie Sullivan of Wisconsin originally. She's director of student relations for the organization QuestBridge.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrat.
It's time for Food Friday, and today we're going to dive into the perfect baking project for a fall weekend, homemade pretzels.
Yeah, and it's a Packers weekend. I can't help but notice. Pretzels, Packers, both start with that letter P. Coincidence? We'll also be talking homemade mustard and get one of our guests' favorite bread recipes.
So we're going to get going now with cooking instructor and chef Ian Knauer. He's the host of the PBS show The Farm and the author of a cookbook by the same name. Hey, Ian.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good, thanks. Well, so I know that the baking is close to your heart, and we're going to start with a trendy food these days. We're going to start with pretzels. So what kinds of different pretzels are there out there for the home cook to think about?
Well, I mean, you have your basic soft pretzels and hard pretzels. I'd say that those are the two main categories. Of course, you can also get into pretzel rolls and pretzel sticks and you can do whatever you want with it, essentially, pretzel ice cream cones. But I would stick to the soft and the hard just to start out.
Can you tell us, before we get to the how-to, what do we know about the history of the pretzel?
Well, as far as I know, it's of German origins, in fact, like many Americans. And if you look at the areas of America where Germans originally settled, you see a lot of pretzels in those areas. So you'll see a lot of – there's pretzels in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, in New York, in Chicago. And those areas are still kind of famous for pretzels. You see them a lot in stadiums and on street food and that sort of thing.
I feel like pretzels are really trendy these days. They're all over pretzel rolls, like you said. I was in Venice Beach. This was a couple years ago, but there was a whole giant store just dedicated to pretzels. Are they still, you know, peaking out where you are on the East Coast?
I mean, around here, the pretzel has never gone out of style. So they're still small companies, still Pennsylvania Dutch companies that have been making pretzels for years and years and years and continue to do so. And they're still fantastic.
Now, we can go to a store and buy pretzels penny on the pound, more or less. Why make our own pretzels?
Well, why make your own anything? I mean, why make your own ice cream when Häagen-Dazs does a perfectly good version?
Yeah.
Because it's fun. Because you get to see what goes into your food. And because it's a great way to, you know, spend a couple hours. So, I think you should make pretzels and ice cream and your own sriracha and your own mustard and everything that you possibly can.
Wow, you're getting a little crazy there.
Yeah. Well, but wait, you can make your own pretzel ice cream cone and your own ice cream to put in it. Then you got something.
That sounds right. Pretty good.
Never leave the house again.
Are there distinguishing things that make a pretzel? I can think about the salt and the shape. Are there other things?
Sure. Actually, the process itself is a little unusual. It's not just baked. Pretzels are similar, in fact, to bagels, in so much that they're poached first and then they're baked. And on top of that, they're not just poached in salt water like a bagel would be, but they're poached in water that has lye in it. And lye is a chemical that gives it that sort of characteristic dark brown color and that crunch on the outside.
All right, let's get cooking here. What tools do we need to make our pretzels?
Well, you start out with a bowl, and of course you can mix the dough by hand.
Bowl.
It's
check.
A fairly straightforward bread dough. It's got yeast in it. I like to add a little brown sugar for, a slight sweetness. But you could also use molasses or a malt powder would work really well. It would give you a nice malty flavor. But other than that, the dough itself is basically a yeast dough. So you let that rise, and then you form it into your pretzels. Now, again, these could be any shape, and you do this by hand also. So you could just roll it out into a stick if you want, or you can sort of get fancy and tie it in a pretzel knot. But again, so far, you are not using any special equipment. But now we need to poach them. So what we need now is a pot of simmering water and some chemical. Now, typically, in industrially made pretzels will be cooked with lye. And you can buy lye. You can buy food-grade lye. That's what is used for that. And you can buy it over the internet or really any specialty food store. Or you can just use baking soda. You can use spread some baking soda on a baking sheet and actually bake it. So you end up with baked baking soda. It sort of intensifies it and gives you a chemical that's very, very similar to lye and has the same effect at home. So you put your baked baking soda in your simmering water. You poach your pretzels, which means you drop the pretzel that you formed into that water until it sort of sets. And then you take it out, and then you bake it. After you take it out of the water, you would sprinkle it with salt, and you would bake it on a baking sheet. So to sum up the equipment that you would need, it would be a bowl, a pot, an oven, and a baking sheet. So really not that much.
Well, I had a kind of mixed experience when I tried to make homemade pretzels. When you got to the poaching phase, they looked beautiful going into the pot of, you know, boiling water with whatever, I think I just used baking soda. But when I tried to take them out, it was incredibly hard and they got gloppy and mangled and they looked really unpleasant. And I ended up using maybe sort of a wonton scooper to try to get them out. I was experimenting with about every utensil that I had. What do you advise?
Well, a couple things. One, I would, instead of having boiling water, I would have simmering water. So that the water itself doesn't really jostle the pretzel around too much. It sounds like you might need a little bit more baking soda in there so that they don't get too gloppy. But then traditionally what people use are sticks, and they look like big chopsticks basically. And they just sort of stick this big stick, in one of the little sections of the pretzel and scoop it out and put it right on the baking sheet. Really what you need is a lot of practice to do this, because the more you do it, the faster you'll be, and the faster you are, the less chance you have to end up with a mess.
I'm just picturing Veronica's Cthulhu-esque pretzels of doom.
they tasted really good, but they were ugly as sin. They were not pretty.
Okay, so the salt, it seems like it's key to the pretzel, right? What kind of salt? I mean, do you do like a big coarse kosher salt, or I don't know, can you get fancy with it?
Yeah, you can actually buy pretzel salt, which is what you'll see on soft pretzels, for instance. It's that big, coarse, chunky salt. You could use coarse kosher salt. That would work fine. Actually, one of my favorite salts to use is a Malden salt, which is a really flaky sea salt. It has a wonderful flavor and also a really nice texture. It sort of like crunches and dissolves at the same time. So you can be as creative with the salt as you want to be. Yeah, just have fun with that.
And we're going to play a quick round here of Stump the Chef. Hmm?
Okay.
Rob and I were talking before the show,
oh, yeah.
And we both kind of communally came up with this idea that sounded really good to us. Could you do a pretzel bread pudding?
Like bread pudding, but with pretzels.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. And I would, you know, I would throw in some chocolate in there as well, and probably some streaks of peanut butter. So you end up with like a pretzely Reese's peanut butter cup. In a bread pudding, of course.
Yum.
We're gonna be back in a while. We'll play a tape of something. I gotta find something like that and eat it right now. I was thinking like caramel too would be really good with that.
Caramel would be fantastic. I mean, if you think about the ways that you would want to eat a pretzel ice cream cone, what kind of ice cream you would want on there, dulce de leche or a caramel ice cream would be at the top of my list. Because caramel and salt are such good bedfellows, they're such good friends, that's why we have things like salted caramel. So to do a caramel pretzel bread pudding or pretzel ice cream with caramel, that just sounds like heaven to me.
You can whip up a batch, Ian, and send it to us here at WPR. Just let us know if it works. Yeah, overnight. Perfect. Well, I suppose a more traditional way to go with pretzels would be to dip them in mustard. And, you know, I think of mustard as something one buys at the store. But, of course, you being you, Ian, you said we should be making our own mustard.
Well, it's not that you should be, but it's that you can. And mustard is a really fun thing to make. It actually takes a couple days. So you start with mustard seed, or you can start with mustard powder. But my favorite way is to start with the seed, and you soak that in water. And that actually sort of wakes up the enzymes in the mustard and gives it a little thickening power. And then you blend that with your vinegar salt mixture, or you could add honey or maple syrup or a little brown sugar if you wanted a sweeter mustard as well. And depending on how smoothly you blend that is the style of mustard that you have. So if you don't blend it at all, it's a whole grain mustard. Blend it a little bit, it's a grainy mustard. And if you blend and blend and blend and then strain it to get out all the skins, then you have a smooth mustard.
What's your favorite for a soft pretzel and mustard combo?
Ooh, I'm really torn. I like a grainy mustard, and then I also like a smooth, sweet mustard. In this part of the state, we have this sort of traditional Pennsylvania Dutch mustard, which is quite sweet but also acidic. And that actually is telling of a lot of the region's cuisine, which is has a sweet, sour play to it. So I like both of those.
Well, we're talking right now about homemade pretzels on Food Friday, talking with Ian Knauer, cooking instructor and chef. And by the way, we've got one of Ian's favorite recipes for crunchy pretzels on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you ever tried your hand at homemade pretzel making? Did anything trip you up, or do you have some success stories to share? Do you have any secrets of pretzel making or mustard making or other things to do with your pretzels? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about homemade pretzels and more today on Food Friday. And joining us is cooking instructor and chef Ian Knauer. He is also the host of the PBS show The Farm and the author of a cookbook by that same name.
We want to hear from you. Have you embraced pretzels lately? Do you serve them on game day? Packaged, hot or cold? What do you serve them with? Mustard? Do you like them in ice cream? And have you made your own homemade pretzels? Share your story. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can post on the Central Time Facebook page where, by the way, you can find some recipes.
And Ian, while we were listening to the news, they were also thinking about different applications for pretzels. And pretzel rolls are sort of ubiquitous today. What do you think about the pretzel roll? Is that going to be easy to modify here for our recipe?
Oh, absolutely. I would start with a more basic bread dough. So I might not put the brown sugar in the dough. Then just form it into a roll. And you're still going to want to poach it, like we talked about earlier, in a lye solution or a baking soda solution before you bake it off and sprinkle it with salt.
So it is, that's what I wondered. I thought they might just be baked, but you actually do poach it first. Even though it's a roll, not a pretzel, sort of, it still gets poached first.
You do. So, I mean, I would think about it as a soft pretzel, basically, instead of a roll, because you still have that soft, tender inside, but you have that golden brown crust, and that's really what distinguishes it from other breads. And the poach in the lye water or the baking soda water is what gives you that sort of characteristic golden brown color, and the thicker, you know, slightly tougher chew on the outside as well.
I'm going to ask an embarrassing question. I don't know exactly what lye is. What is lye? Rob is sniggering. You're sniggering at me.
I'm glad you asked.
Okay, good.
No, I'm going to give you a slightly embarrassing answer. I'm not exactly sure.
Good. It's all of us.
I think it's from another planet.
It's a caustic chemical. It's very similar to like drain cleaner, for instance. But don't get too scared. There are food grade varieties of it that are much more watered down than what you might buy to clean with. And they are safe to eat.
Okay.
But I do have to say, though, if you're using it at home, you should wear rubber gloves because you probably don't want to get it on your skin. Then the baking process, however, neutralizes it. So it's totally safe to eat after the pretzels are baked.
Oh, interesting. Okay, let's go to a caller now. Nicole joins us in Greendale.
Hi. I thank you for taking my call, first of all, and I'm so excited about the topic because for years I have been looking for a recipe to recreate my heritage German style pretzel. And it's a unique pretzel in it's a pretzel shape, but it has a very thick middle. It's usually served sliced open with butter and meat or cheese. And I was wondering if your guest has any hints or tips where I can find the perfect recipe, because the things that I've tried so far are close, but not quite. And I do have food grade lye at home, and that is, oh my gosh, that is the huge difference between baking soda and an actual pretzel.
Interesting, Nicole. Thanks so much. Well, any advice for her, Ian?
Well, I think, Nicole, I think I know the pretzels that you're talking about. That sounds really similar to a Bavarian style pretzel, which is a soft pretzel. and has sort of a thicker middle, and then the ends of the pretzel come to a point. So when you're rolling it out in a log, you leave the middle basically thicker than the ends. So that sort of gives you a doughier, thicker part of the pretzel that, yes, it's very common to slice that in half crosswise and then butter it, which is pretty much the most delicious way to eat a pretzel is with butter. I would try adding some malt powder to that because you're going to get a really sort of deep caramelized sweetness, but it's not actually going to be sweet. It sort of helps balance out that the saltiness of the pretzel itself. So I would start with that. Probably use a ratio of about 3 cups of flour to about a cup of water for your dough. You might want to play with that a little bit, but you're basically going to have a fairly dry dough for that style. A lot of German baking has a drier dough than, let's say, French baking or Italian baking. So I would start with those proportions and then work from there.
Nicole, good luck, and thanks for your call. Now you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice or questions about making pretzels and what to serve them with.
And as far as what to serve them with, you know, this is Wisconsin. We're legally required to serve them with cheese sauce, right? I think, definitely.
Sure, I'd do it.
That's how I would eat them. So, so Ian, is there an easy, you know, sort of cheese sauce recipe that you could recommend?
Sure. You know, I would work off of a Welsh rarebit or a Welsh rabbit recipe, which is essentially a cheddar sauce that has some beer in it. So you're killing a lot of birds with one stone here. You've got your beer, your cheese, and your pretzel.
Perfect.
So I'd work with that. Yeah, that sounds delicious.
And you also, if people want to bake this winter, but maybe pretzels aren't their thing, you also have a basic bread recipe and some bread making advice. And I know that we've talked to you about bread some before, Ian. What do you got for us today?
Yeah, it is the time of year to turn on the oven again and get baking. You know, it's getting cooler here. I'm sure it's getting cooler there, too. So it's a great time to roll up your sleeves and make some bread. The recipe that I sent you guys is my go-to bread recipe. It's really simple. It's really straightforward. It's only 4 ingredients. It's just water, yeast, salt, and flour. And I use an all-purpose flour because it's what I have at home. You know, there's no need to get fancy with bread flour with this dough. So I use it for bread itself. I make baguettes out of it. I make rolls out of it. If I added a little bit of brown sugar, I could make a pretzel out of it too. So it's a really sort of universal recipe for that.
Hmm. I made a homemade pizza crust last week after we did a Food Friday about pizza and homemade pizza, and I went through 3 packets of yeast because I couldn't tell if it was working or not. I don't have a thermometer. Do we just need to buy a thermometer so we can make sure that the yeast is at the right temperature? Because that's a stumbling block for me right out of the gate.
Well, no, you don't have to buy a thermometer. There are a couple tips to sort of make sure that your yeast is awake and alive. One is to mix it with your warm water before you add your water to the dough. And make sure that water is warm. And you can just touch it and you know, feel if it's warm. It doesn't have to be a certain degree. If it's warm coming out of your tap, that's perfectly fine. So mix that with your yeast with your water, add a pinch of sugar, and let it sit for 5 minutes. And if it looks foamy, then it's good to go. If it doesn't look like anything, if it looks like cloudy water, then chances are you need to try some fresher yeast. So that's one thing to make sure that your yeast is alive. It's actually called proofing the yeast. You know, you're proving that it's alive. And then the other tip that I would say is to try and get fresh yeast or cake yeast instead of the dried stuff. You can get cake yeast at your grocery store. It's usually with the eggs in the dairy section. Or if you can't find it there, go to your local pizzeria and ask them for some yeast. Every pizzeria uses fresh yeast, and it's easy to use. It's much easier to use than the dry stuff. It's got better flavor, and it works faster, and it always works. So that would be my advice.
Now, when I cook, I often like to be spontaneous about it, but bread takes a little forethought. How much time do we need to allow for the bread dough, the yeast, to rise?
In a warm kitchen, it can take 45 minutes to an hour. And the nice thing about it is that you just set it to the side and forget about it and do something for an hour and then come back to when it's all done. And then you can form your loaf and bake it off.
That's not too much premeditation, though.
It's not that bad, you know, and really you can think about it on your way home and still have fresh bread for dinner. So it's totally doable.
Now, how do you feel about kneading your bread dough by hand versus using a dough hook on a food mixer?
Well, you know, I do have feelings about this.
I thought you might.
If I use the mixer, which I do sometimes because I'm in a hurry, I use the paddle attachment, not the dough hook, because I feel like it does a better job of mixing. But that said, I really love kneading my bread by hand because there's something so tactile about it and so comforting about it for me. It's one of the things about cooking that I really enjoy is kneading bread. It's almost like, you know, going to a therapy session, but it doesn't take nearly as long and it's a lot cheaper. So, you know, I think that's a personal thing. If you don't get the satisfaction that I get out of it, then use your paddle attachment on your stand mixer, and that's perfectly fine.
Now, one thing that I imagine if I were to make bread on the off chance is cutting into that still steaming warm loaf of bread and having a warm slice where the butter melts. As I recall, Ian, I'm wrong. I should not cut into that warm bread.
That's right. When you take your bread out of the oven, it's still baking from the inside out. And so if you cut into it when it's hot before it's cooled, you'll end up with a gummy interior. You've probably noticed that when you've done that before. So the thing to do if you want warm bread is let it cool completely and then warm it up again. That way you can have your warm bread and you'll get this beautiful, nice texture on the inside.
How about the pretzels? Can we eat those still warm?
Yes, absolutely, especially the soft ones. One of the wonderful things about pretzels is their sort of dense texture, and that comes from the poaching process first. If you think about other breads that are poached like that, bagels, for instance, are also really sort of dense and almost like gooey on the inside, and that's what makes them so wonderful.
And for people who are afraid of doing any of this stuff, you know, because it involves yeast and bread and various processes that seem complicated, is it hard to do this stuff, make pretzels and bake bread?
No, it's actually one of the easiest ways to cook is to bake bread, and pretzels included, because the yeast does most of the work. The yeast does the rising and the oven does the baking. It takes about 5 minutes to knead the dough, 2 minutes to shape the dough, and then you're done. So it's 7 minutes of cooking for fresh bread. I mean, that's totally worth it.
All right, Ian, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
That's Ian Knauer. He's a cooking instructor and chef. He's the host of the PBS show The Farm and the author of a cookbook by the same name. Veronica, last week, Lori inspired you to make some of that grandma's pizza crust. Are you inspired this week? Can we count on some pretzels?
Totally. I think I'm going to try to make pretzels if I've got time on Sunday. But yeah, I'm hoping they'll be a little more pleasing to the eye this time instead of the mangled version. But yeah, what about you?
Well, I'm going to wait for you to bring him in on Monday, of course. No, right. I might give it a try, and I'm almost persuaded to try bread making, too.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.